Communication contains precious data, but there are things your phone won't tell you. Our next speaker likes to take things apart and put them back together in the wrong way. Lukas Arnold studies computer sciences in his master's at the TU Darmstadt and will present very interesting insights from his research. Please give a very warm applause to Lukas Arnold.
Welcome. IMSI catches are deployed everywhere. The German government, for example, reported that the federal police used them in at least 38 instances last year. And American government agencies were also caught using them even without permission. But we have no idea where they are deployed. There could be even one with us in the room right now. How could you know? The available Android detector apps are outdated and thus none for iOS, while setting up an IMSI catcher has become cheaper and easier. You can build a GSM IMSI catcher for around $20 and a more advanced LTE 4G IMSI catcher for around $2,000. If you want to learn more how companies abuse those tools to target, for example, journalists, take a look at the talk about pedota files from day two. But before we dive into our research, let me introduce myself to you. I'm Lukas, and I'm studying computer science at TU Darmstadt. And I started my bachelor thesis about the Qualcomm MSN interface in iPhones, more on that later, at SEMO in October 2022. And thanks to the funding from the projects Emergent City and Athena, I could continue the research on those topics with my supervisor, Jiska. But first, let's take a look at the cellular security considerations. For our research, we assume that an attacker has a defined set of capabilities. They can block, intercept, and modify over-the-air signals. However, they cannot access their target device in any way beforehand or infect it. That would make our research a bit useless. And by default, your device connects to the base station of its cellular network that provides the strongest signal. But within our model, adversaries can establish rogue base stations. They trick the device into connecting as they advertise a stronger signal. And using rogue base stations, adversaries can exploit some known attack vectors for real-world attacks. A very common one is the missing mutual authentication in 2G. Only your user equipment, so your smartphone, authenticates itself to the network, but not the other way around. And the best thing you can do to improve your security is to disable 2G on your phone right now. It's possible in newer Android versions and also on iPhones with iOS 17 and the enabled lockdown mode. But there are also some flaws in 3G and 4G networks with regards to integrity checks. They can also be exploited in real-world attacks to intercept and manipulate traffic. As most smartphones still support the 2G radio access technology for the foreseeable future, attackers usually try to downgrade their target to a 2G connection by, for example, jamming frequency bands of newer radio access technologies. But in 2G, 3G, and 4G networks, SIM cards have a unique identifier, the IMSI, and phones also got a unique identifier, the IMEI. And adversaries who would like to know which humans are around at a certain location can try to recode those identifiers with so-called IMSI catchers. They fake the authentication process where the IMSI and EMEI are transmitted in plain text. In 5G, we got some improvements as those identifiers are now concealed. And for example, the IMSI becomes a Zuki. However, there are attacks in all radio access technologies to track the location of a known target. And adversaries can also try to exploit vulnerabilities in the firmware of smartphones, especially basebands over the air, to extract even more information and to infect devices without being detected. And in our research, we look at attackers with two types of abilities. We got regular attackers who got a reasonable budget and can employ open source software and access public knowledge. In contrast, state-sponsored actors have unlimited resources and can also force network operators in their jurisdiction to collaborate with them. And our goal is to defend against regular attackers and to make attacks for state-sponsored attackers more expensive, as they usually find a way to attack the target but may not be willing to pay the full price. And there are already some mitigations available against rogue base stations. First, with app-based solutions, usually an app on your phone monitors some parameters, for example, of the baseband, and if it detects a specific activity, it instantly warns the user. However, as mentioned earlier, there are no free, up-to-date solutions for Android or iOS are available right now. Sensor-based mitigations usually rely on a network of dedicated sensors, which work in collaboration to uncover newly set up rogue base stations, for example, by scanning the frequency bands. But such a network is expensive to run, and it's not usually everywhere where users are. And finally, network operators can also try to uncover rogue base stations with the data they collect from their genuine base stations and also the data that is available in their core networks. But so far, there hasn't been a single silver bullet to defend against those kinds of attacks, and instead, it requires continuous efforts from all parties. But with those theoretical considerations in mind, let's have some fun with basebands. But what are even basebands? Modern smartphones include an application processor, and it runs the device's primary operating system. However, it does not implement the complex cellular protocol stack. This is the task of the baseband. And the baseband then transmits data using the device's transceiver and antennas to cellular base stations, and in our simple model, multiple cellular base stations just form a cellular network. And our primary research device was an iPhone 12, and it includes an Apple A14 Bionic application processor and a Snapdragon X55 baseband. And modern iPhones use basebands of two manufacturers. First, we got Qualcomm, and they were the primary focus of my bachelor thesis. And they use the Qualcomm MSN interface, or short QMI, for communication between iOS and the baseband's firmware. And we also got Intel modems in some iPhones. They use the Apple Remote Invocation Protocol. And Tobias Koll, also from Zemo, reverse engineered that protocol. And in Intel, in 2019, Intel sold its modem division to Apple. So maybe we can expect a comeback of this protocol, but it's still some years in the future. Apple switched to Qualcomm modems exclusively with the iPhone 12 and the introduction of 5G. And in September of this year, they renewed their contract with Qualcomm until 2026. So QMI will remain relevant for the coming years. And the baseband interface protocols QMI and ARI use similar concepts but encode the data differently. Both use packet-like structures to exchange data between iOS and the baseband firmware, and those packets usually consist of some kind of binary headers, defining the packet's type, a broader group ID, and a more granular message ID, and together they define the packet's exact purpose when it arrives on iOS or the baseband. And data is encoded with so-called type length value structures. And QMI is also used in Android and on some modems with Qualcomm chips, but its documentation is hidden behind non-disclosure agreements from Qualcomm. But lucky for us, we got some open source project that uncovered its structure, and the most prominent one is libQMI. The same is true for the ARI protocol, which was uncovered by Tobias and his Ars Totalis project. And on iOS, we got the System Process Comm Center that handles all things related to cellular communication. That includes the baseband communication, and to examine that, we got multiple tools available. First, we can use official baseband debug profiles from Apple. When we install them on our device, the device logs all packets in a binary format, and we can just access the system logs to see those binary packets. We can also apply reverse engineering tools such as the interactive debugger FRIDA and the decompiler GITRA. And Yiska already fuzzed the iOS interface for incoming packets, and she discovered multiple vulnerabilities. So it's interesting to look into that. You can find more about that in our talk, Fuzzing the Phone in the iPhone. And by reverse engineering, we found the relevant iOS functions responsible for receiving and transmitting QMI packets in iPhones. And based on the name, we assume that the communication between iOS and the baseband happens over the iPhone's peripheral component interconnect. And we can use that knowledge to pick together what belongs together. So we want to connect libqmi and the iPhone's baseband. And for that, we slightly modify libqmi, apply a FRIDA script on the iPhone that intercepts incoming and outgoing packets, and then also can inject packets. And to connect both, we create a Python script in between, sets up FRIDA, and establishes a link to libqmi over Unix domain socket. And now, effectively, libqmi and the baseband can exchange binary QMI packets, so we can interact from the iPhone's baseband from the outside. We find that the basic communication just works fine, as both employ the similar QMI structure, but the iPhone's baseband only supports 22 out of 94 state retrieving operations implemented in libqmi's command line client. So there's some kind of mismatch. That's why we take a look at the available QMI services. And QMI services bundle similar QMI messages. As I also showed earlier, every message has a group ID or a service ID. And we are able to retrieve a list of QMI services from the baseband. And if we can do that, we get a rough overview of the baseband's capabilities. And one successful operation from libqmi allows us to do that. And we find that the baseband in the iPhone 12, the Snapdragon X55 baseband, implements 39 QMI services, whereas iOS just implements 31. So iOS doesn't utilize the full capabilities of the baseband inside the phone. And we assume that's just the case because the baseband is an off-the-shelf component. And I also brought a little demo of that. First, we forward FRIDA's TCP port to a virtual machine. Then we start our script in between. And then we can execute a command to request all QMI services provided by the iPhone's baseband. There you can see binary QMI packets are sent, and we also receive a response from the baseband, including all those services, and libqmi tries to translate those services, but it doesn't know all the services provided from the baseband, as you can see here. But we also got some services, like the SIR service, which is implemented in the baseband, but not in iOS. And we can also query that using another command, and we get a successful answer. So we know the baseband doesn't lie about its capabilities, and now we can do more with it than before. But we also want to gain a better insight into the communication between the baseband and iOS. There's already an existing Wireshark dissector for QMI out there, but it's built for USB modems, and we adapt it to iOS. And we provide three approaches to extract QMI packets from the iPhone, and they work without and with a direct connection to the device, and they support all types of iPhones, even those without a jailbreak. But we noticed that the dissector cannot translate all message identifiers to textual representations. But those are crucial for understanding what's happening between the baseband and iOS. Therefore, we research how iOS passes and compiles binary QMI packets. And using the tools IPSW and FRIDA, we discovered two new processes, LocationD and Wireless Radio ManagerD, in addition to the ComCenter process. And all three of them pass and compile binary QMI packets, and the two other processes get those via the XPC process communication. But all three processes use the message-based class to create QMI packets. So we took a look at that and devised a semi-automatic message ID extraction workflow. First, we download the firmware we want to inspect. We load the relevant libraries into Gitre. We apply some scripts that search for references to this message-based class and then extract the, for example, function names, put them in a CSV file, and finally another script, convert that to libqmi definitions. And now we got a better overview of what's happening between the baseband and iOS. We can use that Wireshark dissector to inspect the novel emergency SOS via satellite service, which is implemented in the iPhone 14 lineup and was available in Germany since December 2022. And that's when we also started to look into that. And first, we found a novel QMI STUI service on the iPhone 14 baseband. And as you might remember, QMI services bundle similar messages. So the STUI service is responsible for everything satellite related in the iPhone. And if you want to learn more about that, there was an excellent talk about the iPhone satellite communication by Yiska and Alex on day one. But let's put our practical understanding of the baseband communication into practice for detecting rogue base stations. But before, we got another puzzle piece for our detection algorithm, because base stations, as you might have seen those structures, usually hold multiple cells pointing in different directions, and each cell broadcasts a unique identification. And cell location databases link this unique identification with location information, and they can be used to find an approximate location just based on the unique cell identification, which is available to your phone, and also to get an overview of the coverage provided by a cellular network if we are able to retrieve a full list of cells from that database. And iPhones use a multi-sensory approach for gathering location data. This includes cell towers, nearby Wi-Fis, and GPS. And Wi-Fi and cell tower location is powered by App Location Services, Apple's internal cell location database. It provides aggregated data to devices, and in turn, devices also contribute data to that database. And there was already some research into extracting Wi-Fi MAC addresses from this database by Mika Tupola. And our focus was on extracting cell IDs. And Apple's database has an HTTPS endpoint, and its requests and responses have custom binary headers. And that data is encoded with protobuf, and we monitor those requests with man-in-the-middle proxy, and we decoded the protobuf structure with IDAPRO, and found that a request to Apple's database just includes the identification data for one cell, the cell you're currently connected to. And if the cell is in Apple's database, their servers usually respond with location data of 100 nearby cells and 20 larger cellular areas. And for example, a protobuf definition for an LTE cell looks like this. We got some cell identification data, the cell's location, and some information about the frequency bands. And 2 billion Apple devices interact with this database. If you turn on Apple Location Services on your iPhone, then your iPhone is one of them, as written in Apple's Terms of Service. And we found throughout our research that the database provides good coverage across Europe and network generations with a miss rate lower than 1%. And news cells usually take up multiple days to enter in this database, and we also assume multiple measurements from distinct devices. And there are also other cell databases like OpenCellID, and its data set provides 74 million cells, and we can just download the whole data set. But as you can see in this map, it misses some significant parts of the globe. The same is true for Mozilla Location Services, or short MLS. They operate by a similar principle. And for both databases, members collect measurements and contribute that to the database. For Mozilla's database, it contains 63 million cells, but only provides the cells confirmed in the last year to download, so effectively we only get 9 million cells. And we want to validate the database quality a bit. And first we plot the number of cells updated each year. And we find that there are some pretty old cells in OpenCellID. And the cells from Mozilla are quite new. And we also want to compare it to Apple's database. And we, for that, we sample 5,000 cells from an open database for a given country. We check if Apple's database contains them. We collect all cells we get back from Apple's database, and then check again if they are in the open database. And we found that for Mozilla's database, it only provides a low percentage of out-of-service cells, which is good, but covers only a small percentage of a country's networks, which is bad. In contrast, the OpenCellID database covers a larger percentage of out-of-service cells, but also contains a larger percentage of a country's network, which is like the opposite. And it's a trade-off between those two databases. But in the end, Apple's database is just the best because a lot of devices contribute to it. And our use case for that is the rogue base station detection, as outlined earlier. And our algorithm for that is based on cell measurements. Those are basically IRS internal property sets, QMI and ARI packets, location data of your phone. And we use multiple heuristics to evaluate the combined data sets. And those heuristics assign a score from 0 to 100 points to each cell measurement. And the measurements are then grouped into three categories. Untrusted cells are with a high likelihood a rogue base station. For suspicious cells, usually one detection criteria failed, but it could be also caused by just a misconfigured cell or just some other problem. And for trusted cells, our algorithm indicates that it's a cell you can connect to and it's genuine from the network operator, but still there could be some kind of new attack our algorithm can detect. And it's based on 6 detection criteria. And first we check if a cell is in Apple's database, because usually rogue base stations are only active for a short amount of time, and those then not present in Apple's database. We calculate the distance between the location we get from Apple's database and the user location, and if that's larger than 75 kilometers, the maximum range of a 2G cell, plus a lot of error margin, then the cell could be a rogue base station, because cells usually remain in one place. We also compare the cell's frequency channel and physical cell ID with the data from Apple, as attackers may use other channels and physical cell IDs to delay their detection. We check the cell's bandwidth, as more expensive software-defined radios are required to achieve the full channel bandwidth of, for example, 20 megahertz. We search for a network rejection packet, which appears during a failed authentication between smartphone and base station. And implementing a full authentication mechanism for rogue base stations and 3G, 4G is quite difficult, and thus making it more costly for attackers to set up rogue base stations. We also extract the signal strength from the baseband packets, as rogue base stations usually trick their targets into connecting by advertising a higher signal strength. So let's continue with our defense against rogue base stations. The CellGuard iOS app implements the detection algorithm, and it records and links required data points such as cell measurements, packets, and locations. And it's compatible with iOS 14 up to iOS 17, and we use Swift and Swift UI to create it. And our app gets us data on jailbroken phones using Tweaks. Tweaks are external components with evaluated privileges and modify the default behavior of iOS, but require jailbreak with tweet injection to do so. And CellGuard relies on 2 tweaks. They hook into iOS core telephony framework to collect data, namely cells and packets in the background, and then cache that data and provide it via a TCP socket to the app. And as you can see here, this function is used to get data about the cell you're currently connected to. But jailbreaking exploits vulnerabilities to gain system-level access, and we wanted to CellGuard also to be able to run on non-jailbroken phones so that users can install the latest patches from Apple on their devices. Luckily, that's possible with some manual interaction, namely system diagnosis. They are diagnostics for Apple devices and officially supported by Apple and contain logs of various components. To import data into our app, users just install a baseband debug profile, as mentioned earlier, on their device, and then they create a system diagnose by pressing like all the device's buttons and share that from the settings app to SailGuard. Then we extract all data from it using the macOS Unified Logs library by Maniant. And while the official Apple tooling to process that binary log format only runs on Macs and takes a lot of time, this library is quite fast. It usually takes 30 seconds to read our logs, and we can just integrate it in our app because it's written in Rust. And the time frame of extracted data depends on the logs of the device's activity. So if you're using your device a lot, then there are a lot of logs, and you only get like the last 3 hours of data. But if your device is used less, you can also get cells from the last 12 hours and packets. So let's explore a bit how our app works. First, we got a risk indicator, and right now we're in Hamburg, and you can see the cell we're currently connected to, and we also got a list of all cells we've been connected to in the past, and we can check out each cell individually and inspect also each measurement, dig into how the detection algorithm works, and also see the internal IRS data that we recorded. And we can also, on the map, view all cells that we got from Apple's database. There are quite a lot, and the green ones are GSM cells, the blue ones are LTE cells. And we can tap on them, also get more data, as outlined before. And we can go to the packets to just see all packets which are transmitted between iOS and your baseband. And also filter them, for example, by QMI services, and dig into each packet because we also implemented a basic dissector which parses the packet and shows its contents. You can also export all of that data for later analysis on your computer with Wireshark, for example. And to evaluate our app, we set up an LTE music catcher in our lab, tested multiple iPhones with ARRI and QMI basebands, and also based on our findings, we improved the detection algorithm. However, we couldn't convince any iPhones to connect to a 5G standalone or even like a non-standalone network. That might be interesting, but that's a thing for the future. And we also used our app in the wild and traveled through 6 European countries for about 6 months. But it also works quite well. We got a low false positive rate, but if you're moving over 500 kilometers per hour with an iPhone that doesn't measure speed, we got a problem. So maybe you should just turn on flight mode while you're flying. But that's the reason for the spike in dataset 8. So far, we haven't found a rogue base station, which we could confirm, but that's quite difficult because you can't just go to a base station and take it apart. But overall, the majority of cells we connected to were present in Apple's database, making a good mirror of actual networks out there. And by recording such amounts of data, we could evaluate SailGuard with all radio access technologies we support. So when can you try it out? Our goals were to provide insights into IRS processing of baseband packets, monitor the illicit use of base stations, and to protect high-risk groups such as human rights activists or journalists. And so far, we already created novel tooling to inspect QMI packets on iPhones. We reverse-engineered and evaluated data from Apple's database, and we created the SailGuard iOS app to monitor cells around you and hopefully uncover some rogue base stations. But we still have some work ahead before we can release the app. First, we want to improve the detection algorithm. Maybe some machine learning might be helpful to uncover patterns. We also want to enhance the app's user friendliness. And finally, we're working on smart notifications that alert you when you should import data on non-jailbroken iPhones. And we aim for a release next year. But right now, we're already open for a small circle of beta testers. So if you're interested, just write me an email. Thank you for listening to my talk, and thanks to Jiska and Professor Matthias Hollick for the guidance throughout this journey, and I also update you on my social channels. Thank you. Now it's time for your questions.
Thank you so much, Lukas, for your insight into your research. And we have some time for questions left. And I see there are already some people waiting in line. But I want to remind you, you can also post questions via the internet, via IRC, or via Mastodon. But we will start with number one.
Just a quick question. Yeah. Which SDR did you use? You said that it was very expensive to do an IMSI catcher for LTE, and maybe LTE has some bandwidth issues, so you couldn't use a HackRF or something, for example.
Yeah, we used a USRP X310 for our test in the lab.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah.
Next question would be number two.
Yeah, so you said that 5G doesn't transport EMI and IMSI directly?
Yeah.
Okay, can I consider 5G more secure than 4G in that regard?
Yeah, definitely. It has a lot of improvements in that area, and the IMSI and EMMI basically are encrypted with the operator key. There are some attacks, if you Google like Suki catchers around that, but it's definitely more secure than 4G.
Does it mean that the group defining the standards have an actual interest in making it secure, or is it just fake security to calm us down? What do you think?
I think the group that defines the standards actually has an interest to make users secure, but I think there are also some interests to not include all measures we could include.
Thanks.
Next question would be over there.
Is it possible to create a rogue cell with the same ID of a legitimate one, or maybe a further one, but which is not like further than 75 kilometers to bypass that detection?
So it's definitely possible to create a cell with the same ID. Some attacks rely on that the iPhone switches to a new cellular area to basically force it to re-authenticate to the network. But you can also create a cell with the same ID, and that also works quite well. And that's why we also included the other detection criteria. But still, I think there's possibility to even implement more.
And we have another question from the internet.
The internet would like to know, what are the ways to query or download the Apple Cell Tower database without having an iPhone?
I created just a Python client for it, so you can just input the cell identification and then you get back a list of cells. And we're also going to release that together with the app just as open source software, and then you can just query the database as much as you want, because that was quite interesting. The database has no access control or whatever. You can just send requests without any special headers identifying your phone.
Next one is number two.
Okay, so I've got the inverse question. Is the writing to the database protected in any way? I.e., the attacker could just push their fake cell there?
Yeah, so that's still ongoing research. We're trying to look into it. So far, we just noticed how everything works, but we still have to exactly find out the endpoints, how data is pushed into the database. But we assume that's not like the same endpoint as querying data.
Thank you.
Next one, number one.
There are a number of attempts that have been made to detect fake base stations employed by government actors, often local police agencies. And one of the problems is that there have not been many true positives. This ends up informing the research to where tools, for example, Croc Hunter, have criteria that don't necessarily align with the properties that a deployed base station would have. One exception is the Oslo study from Aftenposten in 2014. Have you compared your diagnostic criteria to the ones evidenced by the findings of base stations in the raw data from that study in Norway?
So far, we didn't do that, but would be nice if you just could send me an email. Okay. We definitely plan to look into it, but Same is true for the detection algorithm. There's still a lot of room for improvement, and we also want to base that on the findings of other studies. That's why we also don't want to release the app right now, because I think it's still in progress.
And another question from the internet.
The internet would also like to know, in your work you focused on rogue base stations, but are such things also done by normal base stations? Did you have a look into that?
So we collected data over the 6 month period, and we usually found that some kind of error, if you're moving too fast or so, usually we get some true positives, like 1% or so, for either cells which are quite new installed, or there are also some cells which can move around like mobile base stations. So those are also properties of cells, and we also aim to include that. And that's why we also got the categories to not alert the user if just one thing goes wrong.
And one last question from number two.
We have a sponsorship package for the research. We have this zero KYC, totally anonymous eSIM for your mobile phone.
Here it is. Thanks.
Thanks. Okay, so this is my question. So some European countries, including the UK and Denmark. Okay.
Yeah.
So some European countries, including UK and Denmark, have their own national databases for the locations of the base stations. Have you also considered those kind of data sets when you are evaluating the accuracy of the Apple's database? Mm-hmm.
So far, we didn't do that, but I think I also found a database of France, for example.
Uh-huh.
But like querying these databases so far, we didn't do that. But that's mm-hmm. also a very good idea to compare the Apple database to official databases and see which one is updated more recently, for example, mm-hmm. and where are the differences.
Thank you.
Lukas, thank you so much for your insights, for your talk, for your time, for your answers for our questions. And please give a warm applause to Lukas Arnold.